Here on Radio 4 FM, it's our Book of the Week, Andrew Wilson's new biography of the early life of the American writer Sylvia Plath. The 21-year-old Plath is a student at the elite Smith College in Massachusetts, but a much-anticipated work placement in New York has unforeseen consequences. Hayley Atwell reads Mad Girl's Love Song by Andrew Wilson. Sylvia Plath's words are read by Sasha Pick.
In the first few months of 1953, much of Sylvia's attention was directed towards her new boyfriend, Myron Lotz. On the 18th of February, she wrote to her mother to tell of her excitement at seeing Myron at the weekend. He was supposed to be driving up to Smith in a new car, a vehicle that represented to Sylvia a symbol of their new freedom together. When Sylvia received a telephone call to say that he wouldn't be able to travel up to Smith, the news upset and unsettled her. She likened its effect on her mind to the destruction and collapse of a building.
He didn't come, and didn't come, and didn't come.
She was inspired to write two villanelles, to Ava Descending the Stair and Mad Girl's Love Song. The latter included the repeated line,
I think I made you up inside my head.
The writing of the villanelles lifted her spirits a little. She recognised that the poems were the best she had written and sent them straight off to various literary magazines. In March, she heard back from The New Yorker. An editor at the magazine said that while there were many things they liked about her work, the two poems she had submitted, Mad Girl's Love Song and Doomsday, another villanelle, just did not make the grade. We were somewhat bothered by the two rhymes that break the scheme, especially up, which is not even an assonant rhyme here, wrote the editor. Do try us again. But the following month she heard that Harper's would pay her $100 for To Ava Descending the Stair, Doomsday, and Go Get the Goodly Squab. Then, in April, she heard that she had been awarded $10 for Mademoiselle magazine as a runners-up prize in the third assignment for the annual guest editorship contest. Mademoiselle had developed a reputation for publishing the work of literary figures such as Truman Capote, William Faulkner, and Dylan Thomas. Its typical readers were college girls, career girls, and young marrieds. All year, Sylvia had been submitting assignments to the magazine in the hope of securing one of 20 month-long placements. At the beginning of May, Plath heard that she had won one of the guest editorships. She must have been thrown into a minor panic when she received a letter from the magazine advising her on what clothes to bring. The salary for the month would be $150, out of which she would also have to pay for her room and board. When, at the end of April, she did splash out and spent $85 on a pair of white linen heels, a black silk dress, and a Mexican print linen suit dress, she wrote to her mother pleading with her not to scold her, adding that she would try to sell more of her poems. Sylvia was acutely conscious of her mother's tight economic situation, and she constantly worried about her. In May, she wrote to her brother Warren,
You know as I do, and it is a frightening thing, that Mother would actually kill herself for us if we calmly accepted all she wanted to do for us. She is an abnormally altruistic person, and I have realized that we have to fight against her selflessness as we would fight against a deadly disease.
After finishing her stint at Mademoiselle, Sylvia hoped to go to Harvard Summer School, ideally to take Frank O'Connor's short story course, and applied for a scholarship to help cover the costs. On the 1st of June, Sylvia's first morning in New York, she arrived at the offices of Mademoiselle. Having won her place on account of her abilities with fiction, she was holding out hopes of a position on that team. She was less than thrilled when she discovered she had been chosen as the guest managing editor, under the supervision of the real managing editor, Cyrilly Abels. Although Sylvia became quite close to a couple of the other guest editors, others found her behaviour objectionable. The first day at Mademoiselle, the guest editors were treated to a lunch at an upmarket restaurant. Anne Burnside Love recalls being astonished by Sylvia's behaviour in the restaurant.
It was a lunch designed for the girls to get to know one another a little better, and We were at that stage where we were watching one another very carefully, all of us groping to see what we should do, how we should behave. Very shortly after we were seated at this nice table with a white tablecloth, a large bowl of caviar was served. The caviar was supposed to be for everyone at the table, but Sylvia reached out for it, pulled it in front of her, and began eating. She proceeded to eat the whole bowlful of caviar with a spoon. I remember thinking to myself, how rude! But she didn't seem to be paying attention to anyone else.
In The Bell Jar, Plath incorporates the caviar incident into a scene in Chapter 3 when the guest editors attend a lunch. The novel's protagonist, Esther, has not had time for breakfast, and as she is ravenous, she tucks into the caviar, devouring the whole bowl herself. For Esther, as for Sylvia, the caviar became a symbol of everything that she desired but had so far been denied. Sylvia described her time in New York as a deadly mix of pain, parties, work. She knew she should have been excited about the month in New York, but there was something wrong with her reactions.
I felt very still and very empty, the way the eye of a tornado must feel, moving dully along in the middle of the surrounding hullabaloo.
She described the train that would take her home from New York to Wellesley as a coffin, and although a spirit of black humour runs through the lines, there is no doubt that by the end of June, Sylvia was feeling seriously disturbed. What had she experienced to make her feel so ill at ease? On the 20th of June, she had met, at a country club dance in Forest Hills, a Peruvian man, whom she described in her journal as cruel. She did not expand on this, neither did she detail how his cruelty manifested itself. On her return from New York, Sylvia was met by her family at the station. Her mother described her as looking tired and unsmiling, and as a result, Aurelia dreaded telling her daughter the news that had come that same morning, that Sylvia had not been accepted onto Frank O'Connor's short story class at Harvard. Aurelia tried to tell Sylvia in as casual a way as possible, but she recalled looking into the rearview mirror of the car and seeing Sylvia's face turn pale, and the look of shock and utter despair that passed over it alarmed her. We know from Sylvia's journal that by early July she recognised that she was sick in her head and told herself that she had to stop thinking about self-harming, even the possibility of ending it all. On the 15th of July, when Sylvia came downstairs, Aurelia noticed that her daughter had a couple of partially healed scars on her legs. After being questioned about them, Sylvia told her mother that she had gashed herself in an effort to see if she had the guts. Then she took hold of Aurelia's hand and said,
"Oh, Mother, the world is so rotten. I want to die. Let's die together."
Within an hour, the two women had booked an appointment with the family doctor, Francesca Racciopi, who recommended immediate psychiatric counselling. In order to try to shake her out of depression, Dr. Tillotson prescribed a course of electroconvulsive therapy. At this time, it was often the case that ECT was administered in an unmodified form, without the use of muscle relaxants, and as a result, patients suffered from severe convulsions. Sylvia's badly administered ECT fractured and erased her already fragile sense of identity. According to her mother, Aurelia,
after the first poorly conducted shock therapy in 1953, her own powers of accurate recall, factually and emotionally, were impaired.
Even after enduring the frightening sessions of ECT, Sylvia valiantly tried to carry on as if nothing had happened, still subscribing to her mother's view that one had to show a brave face to the world. Yet she knew she was not feeling any better. If anything, she felt sure that she would spend the rest of her life in a mental asylum. Sylvia could not bear the shame of it. Neither could she countenance the fact that her mother, already short of cash, would be economically ruined as a result. On Monday, the 24th of August, Aurelia left her daughter with her grandparents while she went into Boston to see a documentary about the coronation of Elizabeth II. Waiting until she had the house to herself, Sylvia crept upstairs, where she broke the lock of her mother's steel case and took out a bottle of sleeping pills. She scribbled out a note to say that she was going for a long walk and that she wouldn't be back for a day or so. Then she carried a glass of water and the bottle of pills to the basement. When Aurelia walked into the dining room and found Sylvia's note, she knew something awful had happened. She phoned the police to report her daughter missing. On Wednesday, it was reported that despite 2 days of searching, Sylvia still had not been found. At noon on Wednesday, the 26th of August, while the family was eating lunch, Warren heard a moan coming from the basement. He rushed downstairs and quickly cleared away the pile of firewood blocking the entrance to a crawl space. There, he saw Sylvia, returning to consciousness, a near-empty bottle of sleeping pills by her side. Could Sylvia's suicide attempt have been a delayed reaction to her father's death? Certainly Sylvia later thought so, as she wrote in her poem, Daddy.
At 20, I tried to die and get back, back, back to you.
If anything, in the days following her return from the dead, it seemed as though Sylvia was getting worse. In a letter to Olive Higgins Prouty, Aurelia wrote,
Sylvia is retreating inwardly. Her speech and comprehension has slowed down. I am thoroughly frightened. This is a nervous breakdown. The one illness I several times jokingly said that we could not afford to have.
Olive Higgins Prouty told Aurelia not to worry. She would take care of the hospital bill up to a sum of $500. In September, Sylvia was admitted to McLean Hospital in Belmont, where she was assigned a young female psychiatrist, Ruth Boysha. In her first few weeks at McLean, Sylvia seemed almost catatonic. Wilbury Crockett, her old high school teacher, would visit her once a week, armed with a word game called Anagram. Using its letters, he would spell out simple words for her, but he later recalled that Sylvia was so unresponsive that, at first, she couldn't form basic terms such as and. By the end of November, the doctors at McLean came up with a plan to prescribe Sylvia another round of electroshock therapy. Dr. Boysha was astonished when her vulnerable patient seemed to show signs of recovery after only 2 or 3 treatments.
I don't know what happened, said Boysha later. Nobody can explain why Sylvia got over her depression. Inside, she just reorganized so she wouldn't have any more ECT.
And tomorrow at the same time, Sylvia Plath pursues her ambition to travel to Europe. Hayley Atwell was reading from Mad Girl's Love Song by Andrew Wilson. Sylvia Plath was played by Sasha Pick and Anne Burnside Love by Hannah Wood. The book was abridged by Miranda Davis and produced by Emma Harding. And Sylvia Plath's novel, The Bell Jar, is our book at bedtime this week. The next part is tonight at 10:45 here on Radio 4. After the news, in Woman's Hour, Sarah Harding from Girls Aloud on her new stage role, and the blogger The Fleet Street Fox reveals her identity. Woman's Hour with Jenny Murray is in a couple of minutes.
Blake Morrison, Melvyn Bragg, Simon Armitage and Julie Bindle discuss the impact of Toni Harrison's seminal poem, V.
It had a profound effect on me because for the first time somebody had intelligently and eloquently and politically described what was going on.
Followed by a reading of the poem in full by the author.
Communist v fascist, left v right, class versus class, as bitter as before, the unending violence of us and them.
V by Toni Harrison on Monday evening at 11 on BBC Radio 4.